Public housing in Illinois has had issues for years now.
You know, I recognize the emotional attachment people have to the places where they live. I think they understand that these units are not, you know, a place that we can just say, okay, go ahead and live there.
That was HUD Secretary Ben Carson on a visit to Illinois last year. That audio is from the Southern's Molly Parker, who joins us today to talk about the demolition of two more public housing units, which leaves 500 people forced to find new homes. Also, we'll be talking about new penalties proposed for distracted drivers in Illinois. But first, recently Illinois lottery players brought millions of tickets worth tens of millions of dollars, even though the top prizes were already handed out.
Once all the top prizes are gone, they remain on the market for weeks and sometimes months after there's no top prize that's available to be won anymore.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. We'll get started just after the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you hear this, do you feel like you're going to win big?
Channel 9 brings you the official winning number in the Illinois State Lottery's daily game. Drawing tonight's number is Karen Smith and the lottery official.
Even the most optimistic of us can feel like the deck's a little stacked against you when it comes to the lottery's odds. And recent investigative reporting from the Chicago Tribune finds those odds can be even worse than we thought. People are buying tickets for games that no longer have top prizes available. I'm joined on the line now by Chicago Tribune reporter Matthew Wahlberg, who's been reporting on the Illinois Lottery. We're also speaking with Anita Bedell, who's the executive director of the Illinois Church Action on Alcohol and Addiction Problems. Matt, Anita, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Matt, let's start with you in this reporting. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you found?
Well, what we found was that my colleague and I had done some work a while back where we looked at how the lottery had begun to end games early before all top prizes could be claimed. And that happened over a period of years. And then this is sort of the opposite of that. This is a situation where games, you know, they have a set number of prizes, and obviously the bigger the prize, the fewer there are. And so what is happening and continues to happen is that once all the top prizes are gone for these games, they remain on the market for weeks and sometimes months after there's no top prize that's available to be won anymore. So, for instance, in one game, Fabulous Fortune, which is a $20 game, the top prize was $4 million. And that was gone some time ago, actually. It was gone in January 29th. And they've continued to sell it and are even still continuing to distribute that game to retailers.
Anita, how does Illinois differ from other states when it comes to keeping these tickets on the shelves?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but Illinois is different that we have a private manager of the lottery. So they get incentive bonuses as a percentage of the profit. So if these tickets are allowed to stay on the shelves after all the big winners are gone, that's more profitable for the companies.
And Matt, I wonder if you can weigh in on that in terms of, it doesn't sound like there's a specific regulation in Illinois that says after the top prize is gone, these tickets need to be pulled.
Actually, it's the opposite. On the back of each ticket that's sold, there's a disclaimer that says that the lottery has the right to continue to sell tickets after all top prizes are claimed. So consumers are given notice. The question is, when are they given notice? And because of the way that the lottery sells these tickets, and we've all seen them in gas stations, it's very difficult, if not impossible, depending on where you're purchasing these tickets, to view the back of the ticket prior to purchase. So the only notice that players would reasonably get that this policy is in place is if they've, A, read the back of a ticket before and know this, but in that case, they probably would have purchased the ticket prior to knowing that policy, or B, let's say I'm a first-time player and I decide, oh, I want to get a ticket around the holidays or something like that, and I purchase a ticket. I don't do it that often. I buy it and stick it in with a stocking stuffer or something like that. I wouldn't know unless I actually read the back of the ticket that this policy was in place. I wouldn't know before I purchased, laid down my $30 or $20 or $10 for that ticket.
And Matt, how much do scratch-off tickets cost? I'm going to display my ignorance here because I feel like I haven't done this in a long time, but I didn't realize some of them are as much as $20 each.
Yeah, the lottery has a range of games. They go from $1 all the way up to $30. Some states have even higher scratch-offs, as high as $50, but those are pretty rare. The bulk of the tickets are sort of in the two to three to five, and with five really being the sort of the heart of the order.
And Matt, can I just go back to ask you about the language of all of this? And you said it's on the back of the ticket. It's a bit of a conundrum there, as you said, because you have to buy the ticket before you would read the back of the ticket. In your reporting, I know you've talked to people who play the lottery fairly often. Are people aware of this?
There's some people that are aware of it, but a lot of people that I talked to, were not aware of it and did not know it. And in fact, there was one particular woman who did not want to be quoted in the newspaper, but who purchased some tickets, and I asked if I could see them and turned it over and showed her the language on the back, and she had no idea that was the policy. So I'm not sure it's tough to know how widespread the knowledge of this policy is. But I think the question that we're raising is one of notice to consumers. What do they know, from first-time players to veteran players? What kind of notice are they given prior to purchase?
Anita, what would you like to see happen in this situation?
Well, just to comment on what Matt said, the print on the back of these tickets is so small, it's difficult to read. And then some of the top 20 zip codes in Illinois where they have the most sales, those are in lower income districts. So how many people would even understand or take the time to read that? Another concern that we have is that they've done studies, and 5% of the people that buy lottery tickets purchase 51% of the tickets. So you have a lot of addicted people who are going to be buying the tickets regardless. And so that's a concern. Is Illinois ripping these people off?
And do you think that's the case?
Well, I think that the lottery is a losing proposition, because if you get one winner for, say, $500,000 or millions of dollars, how many losers are there? So it is a losing prospect for most people.
Matt, what did lottery officials say to you when you let them know about your reporting in this investigation?
Well, they said two things. So there's really two issues at play here. One is the notice of the policy, and they said that it's printed on the back of every ticket. I asked if the policy was noted anywhere else on the website or at any place at the point of purchase, prior to purchase, and the answer was no, it is not. And then the second issue that we raised in the story was one of notice to players of how many prizes remain. And that is posted on the lottery's website. If you click, go to the Illinois Lottery's website and click on the word winning at the top, you'll get a drop-down menu. And the last item on there is the unclaimed prizes, instant prizes list or something like that. You click on that, and it'll be a kind of a PDF document that lists all of the games. And then it will show how many prizes are left at various price points, including, in every case, the top prize. That list is updated on a regular basis, but it's not always updated at the same interval. So there were two whole weeks where even players that knew to check that sheet to see what prizes remain, there was a lot of time to pass between updates. Other states do it different. South Carolina, I think, is a model that's interesting because they update the number of top prizes daily on their website. You're always going to have some lag time, but updating it daily significantly increases the amount of information that players can access. And the other thing South Carolina does is that once that top prize is claimed, the last one is claimed, they almost immediately close the game, meaning they tell their retailers you can't sell this game anymore, and they pull all the tickets back. So that's a model that differs greatly from what we see in Illinois.
My guests are Matt Wahlberg. He's a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. We'll tweet out details of Matt's most recent story about this if you follow 21ST Show. Anita Bedell is with us as well. She's executive director of the Illinois Church Action on Alcohol and Addiction Problems. I should note, by the way, if you or someone you know has a gambling problem, you can get immediate confidential help by calling 1-800-522-4700. Matt, how many of these games are out there, these scratch-off games in Illinois?
At any one given time? You know, it varies. Games are rolled out usually in small bunches. So they may launch two or three or five games at a time. And they're kind of, they go out and they're, you know, old games come off the market and new games come on the market in sort of a rolling fashion. Generally, what we saw during the period we studied was there's anywhere right around 60 games on the market in total at any given time. You know, that can fluctuate a little bit, but that's kind of where it's at.
And Matt, to the point that Anita made earlier about this Illinois, the changes, Illinois is the first state became in 2011. I know Illinois became the first state in the country to hire a private company to manage day to day operations of the lottery. The Chicago Tribune, this is not the first investigation the Chicago Tribune has done into the lottery and how it's run. Can you tell us a little bit about previous investigations and if you think this is a reflection of previous investigations that you all have done when it comes to management of the way the lottery is in Illinois?
I'm not exactly certain who is enforcing the policies and practices. We reported in our earlier series that under North Star, the number of tickets printed for large games dramatically increased. And that enabled them because ticket sales cover the costs of the prizes, right? So if you want to have really big prizes, you have to be able to mathematically justify that by printing lots of tickets. And with every game, there's sort of a natural sales curve. So even though they did sell more tickets and people bought more tickets, sort of the natural bell curve where it sells really hot at the beginning and then begins to taper off meant that sometimes the game was really tailing off before, you know, it got to sort of the end of the game where there were maybe other prizes, top prizes remaining, and the game would be ended before those top prizes would have ever gotten on the market. And so that was the pattern we found under North Star. Now, the state severed ties with North Star and has hired a new private manager, which is called Camelot Illinois, and it's a subsidiary or it's part of a larger company. Camelot actually runs the United Kingdom lottery and has done so for a very long time. So they're transitioning in. They took over January 2nd, but they'll sort of take over the reins fully at the beginning of the next fiscal year, which begins July 1st. Right now, you know, I'm not really sure what's the cause of this current or who is making the decisions for this current practice that we found or pattern that we found of leaving games on after all top prizes are gone. But ultimately, the lottery is the state's property.
Anita, your organization opposes gambling expansion in Illinois. I wonder what your thoughts are with this scratch-off game. If this is, if there's something that you all are interested, are you all interested in pursuing any legal action, or what would you like to see? What are you all planning to do in regards to the scratch-off games?
Well, what we're concerned about is putting the scratch-off tickets on the internet, because besides being the first state to privatize the lottery, Illinois was also the first state to put their lottery sales on the internet. So while they started off with three lottery-type tickets, now they are trying to expand it to Lucky Day Lotto, Pick 3, Pick 4, and they just amended this bill. But before, they had all lottery tickets. They wanted to put all the scratch-off tickets on the internet. And we are very concerned about that, because you could lose money so quickly just by hitting the screen and saying play again, that's a concern, because they always need to expand it and get more money, and the internet attracts young people. And you can gamble on lottery when you're only 18 years old. So this is a big concern that we have.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with us. That's Anita Bedell, Executive Director of the Illinois Church Action on Alcohol and Addiction Problems. Matt Wahlberg is a reporter with the Chicago Tribune reporting on the scratch-off issue. We should note again, if you or someone you know has a gambling problem, you can get immediate confidential help by calling 1-800-522-4700. That's 1-800-522-4700. That's the national hotline on problem gambling. Matt, Anita, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
coming up on the 21st, maybe you've seen some recent headlines about HUD Secretary Ben Carson and his new proposals for increases in the amount renters pay in federally assisted public housing. This is going to impact low-income renters across Illinois. We're going to be talking about that, but we're also going to check in with what's going on specifically with public housing in southern Illinois in Cairo with the Southern's Molly Parker. Plus, what do you do when a text notification comes in when you're driving? It's tempting to look down, but a new law may make the penalty for texting and driving, all distracted driving, even greater. By the way, you can always follow us on social media. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. You can tweet your questions to us during the program. We also tweet out more analysis and background about what we're talking about, including that Chicago Tribune article. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Or if you want another way to ask questions on the air is you can message us via Facebook, search for The 21st to like our page. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's been a tough road for public housing residents in recent years, especially in southern Illinois. Last week, the Department of Housing and Urban Development proposed an increase in the amount most federally assisted renters will pay. This could mean, in some cases, renters could pay triple what they're paying now. That proposal will still require congressional approval. While that plan affects any low-income renters throughout Illinois, today we also wanted to focus on public housing residents in the southern part of the state, in places like East St. Louis and Cairo. About 40 residents living in two public housing complexes in Cairo have until June 30th to move, or they may face eviction proceedings. If you recall, this has been a story that's been going on for a couple of years now. 2016, HUD was forced to take over Alexander County's housing authority after accusations of mismanagement. And over the past year, HUD has decided to close four residences in Cairo and the surrounding areas. All in all, that means nearly 500 people are now looking for new homes, and that's in a market without much private housing that accepts HUD vouchers. Molly Parker from the Southern Illinois has been reporting on public housing in this area for some time. She's on the line now from Carbondale. Hi, Molly. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Bob Palmer's also with us. He's the policy director at Housing Action Illinois. That's a statewide coalition aimed at protecting and expanding the availability of quality, affordable housing throughout Illinois. He's on the line from Springfield. Hi, Bob. Thanks for being here as well.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Molly, let's start with you. Before we get to this most recent news, I wonder if you can fill us in on some of these events for the past few years, and in particular, these four residences that have been closed. Where are they exactly?
They're in Alexander County, which is the southernmost county in Illinois. There are four complexes that HUD has now slated for closure, and we've been on the show before talking about this in Cairo a year ago this spring. HUD announced that they would be closing two family complexes known as Elmwood and McBride that were built in the early 1940s. These complexes were home to about 185 families at the time of the announcement in April of 2017. And so we're about a year out from that time. All but about 40 of those 185 families have relocated. About 40 families were able to stay in Cairo. The rest have moved to other cities with their vouchers, the vast majority of those going to Carbondale in southern Illinois, to Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and some to Paducah and Marion. And then some people have moved as far away as Colorado, Tennessee, Ohio, where they may have had family or friends or other people that they knew. And then in February, HUD made a similar decision in the town of Thebes, which is about 20 minutes away from Cairo, also in Alexander County, to close two public housing complexes there. Those are much smaller, accounting for about 31 families that were living in the complexes at the time in February. And most of those families are still there because they're just starting the process.
Right. And I should point out, we did invite a representative from the Department of Housing and Urban Development to come on the show. They declined. We were able to speak with HUD spokesman Jerry Brown, and he told us that the public housing units that are slated to be demolished were, quote, beyond repair. And he said HUD couldn't let people continue to live there in that state, but they didn't have the money to fix the problem or rebuild the units. And he said, after, quote, years of mismanagement by the Alexander Housing Authority, they thought the best solution was to relocate residents and to give them vouchers. So, Molly, what does this look like in terms of how much public housing does this leave in Alexander County?
Before HUD made this announcement last year, there were about 480 housing units in Alexander County, including these complexes and some others in Cairo and the two in Thebes. They are eliminating about 70% of the housing units, and that will leave about 150, and those are primarily located in two high-rises on the Ohio Riverfront, and a couple smaller scattered developments throughout the city of Cairo. Those are primarily one- and two-bedroom units, which is part of the issue. The complexes that are being closed in Cairo and Thebes are designated what they call family developments, so that's where the majority of people lived who had children. So the people who have been able to stay, like I said, about 40 people have been able to stay in Cairo. Most of those have moved into other public housing units, into these one- and two-bedrooms. So they're primarily seniors who were living out there, or really small families, husband and wife, a couple, or a parent with one or perhaps two children at most. But those families that have multiple children and need larger bedrooms have mostly had to relocate outside of the city.
Molly, what was the condition of the units where people are being asked to leave that are going to be demolished?
The conditions in Cairo, in particular, at Elmina McBride, were pretty tough. Residents complained for years about rats, roaches, mold, electrical systems that were faulty, causing spontaneous fires, plumbing problems, just old. They're very old is a big part of the issue. They were built in the early 1940s, and they do appear to have been neglected. Part of that may have been some amount of mismanagement, and also just over the last decade at least, you know, there's just been massive cuts to public housing. So the housing stock is old. As it gets older, it requires more money to maintain it. The units lacked adequate heat, and the boiler systems, because they didn't keep the units warm, people were heating their units with their gas ovens. And that's common. We're finding that throughout a lot of our older units in southern Illinois, and that's just, it's extremely dangerous. And so, yeah, they definitely showed a lot of signs of wear and tear, and that they were either going to require a massive investment to keep them up to health and safety standards, or they were going to have to close them. And they, of course, chose the latter.
It's Molly Parker. She's a reporter with the Southern. She's been reporting on this issue closely. Bob Palmer, I wanted to bring you in terms of Housing Action Illinois. I wonder if you could comment on the state of the housing complexes that are slated to be demolished, not just in Cairo, but what that sort of says as Molly's describing those conditions. What would you characterize as a state of public housing throughout Illinois? Are a lot of them older units that were built, as Molly's saying, some of these from the 1940s?
That's correct. There is a lot of older public housing, and, you know, the newer public housing that's out there is, tends to be in mixed income developments. As Molly pointed out, there's been historical underfunding of the public housing program. They don't have adequate resources to address their capital needs. There's been kind of an overall loss of units. A lot of people have gotten vouchers when public housing units have been displaced. But there really is sort of a range of public housing across the state, and much of it is, you know, good, adequate housing. We tend to read in the newspapers about, you know, problems in Alexander County or with the Chicago Housing Authority, but there's public housing in every county in the state, and it's an important resource for making sure that people with the lowest incomes have an affordable place to live, which is why we find the proposals that are coming up from the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress so troubling.
And when we're thinking about who's responsible for this in Alexander County, because HUD took it over, that's the federal government. But in general, who's responsible for maintaining the standards of public housing throughout Illinois, Bob?
Well, each county, most every county in Illinois has a public housing authority. And the public housing authority has staff, and they have a board that's generally appointed by the mayor or the chief executive officer for the local government that oversees it. And then there's minimal oversight from the state. It's mostly oversight from HUD. But again, not just have the direct programs for HUD been cut back, but also their staff resources to do audits and oversights and inspections and so forth. And also, you know, along with the proposals to increase rents, there's also been proposals from the Trump administration to reduce inspections and reduce oversight, particularly of small public housing authorities in the area that Molly covers. And that's something else we're concerned about.
Molly, when we think about the housing authority and oversight, obviously Alexander County is a different situation. What's it like in Carbondale?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to talk maybe particularly about one housing authority or another without having spent a lot of time there. I can just say generally across our region, we have housing in varying states. Some of it is much better than others. And a lot of that isn't necessarily due to a mismanagement issue. It is oftentimes an age issue. And you know, there are communities who have much better housing stock. And a lot of this, I think, is driven by the economy. It certainly seems like the national policy at play is to convert all of the public housing eventually to a different platform to require private investment. And that works really well in some places, and housing authorities will tell you they've had great success with those HUD tools. But for those of us who are in, and not just in Southern Illinois, but throughout the country in smaller areas and economically disadvantaged areas, and where the housing stock has reached a point of no return or is getting really close to that, those tools don't generally work. So CARO, I think, is just the tip of the iceberg, where they're talking about moving 400 people, imagine, in a larger city where you have a massive failure trying to move several thousand people. And those are the discussions I don't know that we're having and not having enough of, about how that looks, how that works, and just being really honest with the communities who are facing those issues.
And what are the residents saying to you, Molly, particularly in CARO, about being moved? It sounds like a lot of folks have already left, but for those families that haven't yet to, what are you hearing from them?
I mean, it's really a mixed bag. It really is. I mean, there are families who want out of these, out of CARO, who want out of Thebes, because it's not because they don't love their communities or their neighbors. It really is, and it's a tragedy what we've allowed to happen in these communities. But it really does become about resources. If they can't access jobs, transportation, grocery stores. In Thebes, for instance, there's not even a Dollar General store. The only business there is a packaged liquor store. So that's really tough if you lack access to transportation. And so a lot of families do want to be in more prosperous communities. I think the issue then becomes, when they get their voucher, you have to have landlords in these other communities willing to accept them. And I know that's been a struggle in some cases. Some families have ended up in better situations, and others have struggled to find, you know, what they're looking for with their voucher. But then there are other families for whom leaving is just really out of the question. This is a historic community. Some families have been here for generations, and they don't want to lose their school. They don't want to lose more school children. They've lost about a fourth of the school kids so far, and probably will lose more kids coming into the school year in the fall. And, you know, it's tough. You love your town. You love where you live. And home is something that a lot of us identify with. And even moving just an hour away to Carbondale may not be for someone who's never left Caro, that can be a pretty big hurdle to overcome. So again, it really is a mixed bag. And I think the families that are remaining there now are the ones who either are the most committed to staying in Caro or who are having the most difficulties finding adequate solutions for their families in other communities.
Molly, to your point about the school district, as you mentioned, so the school district has lost a quarter of its students in the past 2 years because of the housing crisis. What kind of impact are you seeing on the broader community with these people leaving?
Well, it's obviously going to downsize the community. And just like with the families, there being differences of opinion, there are differences of opinion in town, too. Some people feel like removing these two large failing housing complexes may allow for some new growth in the future, including for affordable housing, that perhaps some families will be able to come back. But in the short term, there's definitely a lot of pain. And the school district is probably where it's going to be felt the most and the hardest there. And that's not particular to Caro. There's four schools in Pulaski and Alexander counties, and those are two of the fastest depopulating counties in our region. And, you know, there's talk about whether there eventually has to be school consolidation, but there's a lot of challenges about that, too. You know, how you would do that, whether you break up communities in doing that. And there's no question that this is just a really, really painful thing for Caro and will be for Thebes as well.
And certainly, as we saw when schools were closed, the historic school closing in Chicago, that was a very painful situation for a lot of people in Chicago. Bob, can I ask you about the vouchers? And to Molly's point about some people perhaps having a hard time with vouchers, is that true throughout the state?
It is true in many parts of the state that people have a hard time finding landlords that will rent with them because of the voucher, because there's oftentimes preconceptions about the people who have vouchers, or people may have, I think, largely inaccurate preconceptions about what sort of the administrative burden is for renting to someone with a voucher holder. But there are many landlords who like to participate in the program because it's a dependable source of income and they like to provide affordable housing.
And Bob, to that point, I know that you all with Housing Action Illinois are working to expand the availability of quality, affordable housing. What does that look like right now? What are you all doing to help with that issue?
Well, at the federal level right now, we're mostly concerned about these proposals from the Trump administration and certain Republican members of Congress that would actually increase rents for people with the lowest incomes who are living in public housing or have a voucher, that would, you know, eliminate deductions they can take from their income for medical expenses or childcare that would result in them paying higher rents for, you know, implementing work requirements when the majority of people in public housing are elderly or disabled or they're already working, and then also proposals to, you know, either cut funding or not really just not provide adequate funding when there's such a huge shortage of affordable housing in Illinois. There's a shortage of over 300,000 rental units for people with the lowest income. So we feel like at the time, you know, where we're the federal government is cutting taxes for corporations and wealthy people, you know, that's bad policy. What we should really be doing is investing more in affordable housing to help people with the lowest incomes lift themselves up on the economic ladder.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're just going to finish up this conversation with Bob Palmer and Molly Parker talking about public housing throughout Illinois. Molly Parker's been reporting on this for The Southern. Lots of stories about this, including all of her reporting, talking to families directly. We will tweet out that if you follow our Twitter handle at 21STShow. As always, you're welcome to tweet your questions or comments as well to us on Twitter. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about HUD's decision to close 4 residences in Southern Illinois, in Cairo and Thebes. All in all, about 500 people now looking to find new homes. The Southern's Molly Parker has been reporting closely on this issue over the past couple of years. She's on the line from Carbondale. On the line from Springfield, Bob Palmer is the policy director with Housing Action Illinois. Molly, I just wanted to ask you about this June 30th deadline for some of the Cairo families. I know there's been some pushback from both Senators Durbin and Duckworth, both of them issuing a statement calling this June 30 deadline completely unacceptable. They said, considering the absence of affordable housing options in Cairo, what do you hear about what's next with this issue?
Well, HUD announced to the residents last Thursday in a meeting that they have until June 30th to move. I was told by a HUD official that they're going to try to work with families as much as they can if that deadline approaches. And you know, there's all sorts of situations that could come up if you have a unit picked out and it's rented out from underneath you while you're waiting to finalize everything. They did say, you know, they will take things case by case. They didn't tell me exactly, you know, under what scenarios that they would not start eviction proceedings, but they did say they would look at those situations. But the bottom line is it does sound like at this point going forward, what they announced last week is that for families come June 30 who haven't made those efforts to begin moving out, for whom there are not these specific special cases, they will begin eviction proceedings under Illinois law. And Mr. Palmer may be more familiar with the particulars of that, but there is a legal process that involves a court hearing. So it's not just you're not just out on June 30th and locked out. There is a legal proceeding that goes along with that. And as I understand it, they're not starting the eviction proceedings until July 2nd, so shortly after that June 30 deadline. And again, it's my understanding that will only be for those who are making no effort, no movement toward relocation.
Bob, as people are thinking about this, as Molly was talking about this issue, particularly in Cairo, as some issues of this are facing, our rural communities throughout Illinois are facing similar issues. I just wanted to ask, as people hear the headlines in Washington about what's being proposed, what you want people to think about this issue?
Well, again, you know, our federal government made some policy choices recently to, you know, reduce government revenue by cutting taxes for people and corporations that are doing pretty well. Obviously, nobody likes paying taxes, and most people, given the choice, would choose to pay lower taxes. But again, we have people all over the state, all over the country, living in poverty. The proposals to increase rents in public housing and housing choice vouchers is going to impact over 140,000 households across the state. So we should be asking our elected officials to make choices that support the people with the most significant needs, whose housing needs aren't being met in the private market, and that's people with the lowest incomes.
I want to thank Bob Palmer for being with us. He's the policy director for Housing Action Illinois. Molly Parker is a reporter for the Southern Illinois. And both of you, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Using our phones while driving is something many of us do without even thinking about it, even though we know it's not the safest. So we text or look at an alert and don't realize the cost could be fatal. According to the National Highway Traffic Association, 3,450 people were killed in distracted driving accidents in 2016. Last year in Illinois, 1,080 people died in traffic accidents. Illinois lawmakers are now considering a new measure that would make the penalties for distracted driving much more severe, like a moving violation. Those are citations that count against your driving record. 3 of those and your license gets suspended. It's all part of a statewide effort to promote awareness about this issue, which also involves IDOT and the Illinois State Police. State Senator Christina Castro joins us now. She's a Democrat who represents the 22nd District, the Chicago suburb of Elgin. Senator Castro, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you want to take on this issue of distracted driving?
Well, actually, I have a friend. Her name is Charlene Spiting, whose father was killed by a young motorist who was distracted. She was actually, I believe, texting on her cell phone and made a left turn in front of his motorcycle, killing him instantly.
Mm.
So she's been a great champion of this cause, and she was she works for AAA, and she asked if I would introduce last year the first resolution declaring pretty much last week of April Distracted Driving Week. So I've been following this issue very carefully, as well as I remember last year in particular when I read the bill on the Senate floor, I was driving to Springfield, and I always tell this story because, you know, we all are distracted in driving, whether it's changing the radio, some people eat. I was behind a young lady on my way to Springfield who was applying makeup. And when I had a chance, I passed her safely, of course. And then when I looked back in the rearview mirror, she lost control of her vehicle. She was fine, but you could see that she lost control of her vehicle and flipped into a ditch. And this is why the importance of we should focus on the road, keep both eyes on the road. And it's very easy to become distracted, especially with electronic devices such as cell phones.
And what are you proposing then?
So in House Bill 4846, it pretty much cracks down on texting while driving, and it classifies first-time offenses as moving violations. In the past, and when the law was first introduced, it pretty much gave the first-time offense as a warning, with subsequent offenses as violations. This actually takes that out and makes it a moving violation. On top of that, it also increases the penalties. The first offense is $75. The second is $100, and so on and so forth. So, you know, this is the best way to pretty much enhance this, but also to have, I mean, you look at all kinds of things from GPS to cell phones. Everyone is distracted some way, some form, and one way to hinder that or just hopefully make people think twice is if you do make it a moving violation.
Right. And I wonder, as we think about that, how you think, I think everyone knows, I think this is, I want to ask you about the law, but also other things that different folks, including the Illinois State Police, are doing. Everyone knows this is a bad thing. So how do you get people to stop doing it? I mean, I'm even thinking of insurance rates that have gone up because of the amount of accidents that we've seen because of distracted driving. Do you think a law is, I guess, maybe one step?
I think a law is one step. Also, the Illinois State Police, as well as other organizations, are intensifying its education efforts. AAA actually had a model down when we did our press conference, so you can actually see what it's like to try to text and drive, and it's not as easy as it seems. But we need to, you know, especially as technology continues to enhance, we need to educate our young folks and even adults and seniors, mostly younger folks, why texting and driving is bad. You look at some of the cell phones now, pretty much you can turn off your texting. It sends out a message if you, like, for example, if you have an iPhone, you turn it on, it'll send out a message that, hey, I'm driving. We'll get back to you as soon as I'm able. But I think there's a lot of different things that we can do. We have to educate, obviously changing the law. I mean, you have people who still speed, right? People still speed. It is your choice. However, if you break the law, violate the law, then, you know, you get hit with a moving violation and so on and so forth, to the point where if you're constant with it, you will have your license removed.
And where are you at with support for this bill in terms of changing the law that would make it more like a moving violation?
So right now I'm planning, I have the bill. It came, it passed fairly well in the House. So I am going to move it into the Senate, probably not this week, but maybe next week. You know, it's one of those things that needs to be done. It's the right thing to do. And in order to start kind of having people think twice and being distracted driving, we need to make these changes. And hopefully you'll see a change in that. Philosophy means a change in mindset, which means less deaths occurring because of distracted driving.
That's State Senator Christina Castro. She's a Democrat from the 22nd District, represents a Chicago suburb of Elgin, among other places. Senator Castro, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me again.
The The weather's been dry in many parts of Illinois, and the lack of rain, coupled with high winds, creates the perfect conditions for the rapid spread of fires. This morning, the National Weather Service issued a red flag warning for much of southern and east central Illinois, urging residents to be careful with the use of open flames outdoors. To learn more about this, I'm joined by Ricky Castro. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Romeo. Hi, Ricky. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how's it going?
Ricky, what goes into issuing, for the National Weather Service to issue a red flag warning? What do you all consider when you do that?
The technical criteria has to do with the relative humidity levels being less than 25% or 25% or less. And the other key factor is winds generally 20 miles per hour or more sustained. And then frequent gusts as well also helps in that. And then the other factor that goes into it is how dry the conditions going into it are. So, for instance, Chicago's last noteworthy measurable precip was all the way back on April 19th with about 0.4 inches. And so it's been really, really dry over the past couple weeks. So that's a perfect condition to dry out all the, you know, twigs, wooded areas, grassland areas. So that actually dries all the vegetation. The other thing is lack of vegetation as well. Because of how cold it was in April in this case. But in general, dry going in and then the low RH, relative humidity, and strong enough winds is what creates these conditions in which fires can quickly get out of control.
So, Ricky, what happened to April showers, bring May flowers? It was a really dry month, it sounds like, for a lot of Illinois, right?
Yes, exactly. April, cold and dry with snow for the first half of the month. And then just very little precip at all over the last couple of weeks when we're usually expecting 3 to 4 inches of rain on average for the month. Places got generally much less than that from a lot of the state, especially up here. For instance, Rockford was the sixth driest April on record, in addition to being the second coldest.
Wow. And then how big of a geographic area is affected here? I mentioned sort of broadly much of the state. Can you give us the specific parameters for our folks who are listening all over about where in particular the National Weather Service is worried about today?
It would be northern Illinois, our coverage area. Our office, we cover northern, northeastern, north central Illinois, down to east central parts of east central Illinois. So that whole corridor there from northern Illinois down to east central parts of east central Illinois, including Champaign and Vermilion counties, is currently under a red flag warning. That's the area in which the fire danger is considered critical. It's not that it's not high elsewhere in the state. It's related to what the relative humidity values are, et cetera. So, but the windy conditions are still something to keep in mind, even in areas that are not in a warning, that it's still considered elevated fire danger in a lot of the state.
So specifically, Ricky, what kind of behavior should be avoided today?
Any planned burns, that would be we try to get the word out for agencies that are handle prescribed burns to thin out foliage, grassland areas. But that would go for any individual as well, any person that planned to burn something in their backyard legally, obviously, but anybody that planned to do a burn in their backyard, just put it off. The conditions are just, you know, embers could, especially if you're like closer to areas like, let's say, a forest preserve or a grassy area, anything that has additional sources of fuel that could fuel and fires that could then get out of control with the overall dry and windy conditions. So,
Ricky, are you worried about like things like cigarette butts as well?
Exactly. Yeah, cigarette. Being extremely careful with disposal of smoking materials. Being extremely careful with open flames. Cigarette butts are something that has been many times in the past been noted to cause fires to start. Obviously, you know, didn't mean there was any intent there most of the time for sure. But anybody that throws out a cigarette butt that's still partially lit into an area, and then these conditions like this that are favorable for fire spread, then you could actually without unwittingly start a fire.
And how long is this expected to last, Ricky? Is there any rain in the forecast?
Yeah, thankfully we do have some rain in the forecast for much of the area. Probably starting sometime tomorrow, especially tomorrow night through Thursday night. We're looking at a good dose of rain, especially for the northern third or so of the state. Some places could get up to 2 inches or even higher than that in spots. So, and those are some of the areas that have been driest as well.
It sounds like, thankfully, it looks like I'm glad that we have that forecast coming up. I want to thank Ricky Castro with the National Weather Service. Good reminder to be careful today. Thanks, Ricky.
You're welcome.
That does it for us. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.